This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. A few months ago, we received a message on what my friend Charlie Pierce calls the electronic Twitter machine, and it said, "At Only a Game NPR, please take a look at Gene Mingo. I've nominated him 2X for HOF in Canton." Now, it's not going to come as a surprise to any regular listener of this program that I don't care to argue about who gets into the Hall of Fame, but Gene Mingo has had one of those lives. If it was a movie, nobody would believe it. His story is worth telling for reasons that go way beyond whether he should be in the Hall of Fame. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
In at least one way, the defining moment of Gene Mingo's football career, the one that led him from the Navy to the AFL and eventually to the NFL, happened in 1959, the summer before he turned 13. He spent that summer, like all the summers before it, hanging with his cousin, Dean.
His name was Dean Newby, and we were inseparable. Dean was much better looking than me, faster than me, smarter than me, tougher than me. I wanted to be like Dean.
Dean played football for the Akron, Ohio junior bantam team, the Hornets. Before long, he convinced Gene to join him. And for the first week or so, it was good. Gene says he was proud to wear his uniform. But then
the coach called for a scrimmage. I don't forget if I was playing in or playing tackle. But anyway, this boy hit me in my mouth, and I tasted my own blood. And I said, no, this game's too tough for me. And I quit that day.
Dean was angry. He called Gene a quitter. He tried to get him to come back. About a week and a half later, Dean was playing at a neighbor's house. There was a dog there, a boxer. Dean loved dogs.
Dean had been playing at this house all day with this dog there.
Dean went home for dinner and then ran right back to the neighbor's house. But this time, the dog wasn't so friendly.
And he bit Dean's arm and took his veins away. And they rushed him to the hospital. Dean died on the table in the emergency room.
The funeral home prepared Dean's body and put him in a casket. And then he was taken home. Gene and his mother walked over to Dean's house to say goodbye.
And I went in the side door, and my Aunt Honey was standing there, and she was crying. She had this white hanky in her hand that had something like curtain frills along the edge of it. She was wiping her eyes. I heard her say, who's going to be my baby now? Who's going to be my baby now? And I looked up at her and I grabbed her hand and I said, Aunt Honey, I'll be your baby. And she looked down at me and I will never forget this. She said, you can't be my baby. You're a quitter. I told her, I said, I'm never going to quit again.
And at least when it came to football, he meant it.
I went back to Junior Bantams. I asked if I could wear number 13 because that was the number that Dean wore.
Later, when Gene became a drug and alcohol counselor, this was decades after he'd retired from the NFL, he'd say to his charges, do you know that there was once a black field goal kicker named Gene Mingo? They usually said no. But if they asked Gene to tell him more about football, he'd talk about other things.
I told my story, the drug taking me over, what it did to me, that I had shot my wife. I would always share my story because I was no better than them.
When he was 8, Gene Mingo's family moved to a new house in Akron. It was only about 3 blocks from where they had lived before, but it was in what was considered a white neighborhood.
And they said, oh, here come the they thought that we were going to have the old broken down house and cars and everything. We had the best house on the block. Mother didn't allow us to go outside with holes in our blue jeans or shirts. We had to be respectable when we left the house.
Gene skipped school a lot. He'd find a way to sneak out, even on the days when his mother delivered him to the front door. That was before Gene's mom had a series of heart attacks and strokes. By the time Gene was 13, someone needed to stay home and take care of her. One day, after Gene's father got a call saying that he'd skipped school again,
he says, "Son, if you don't like going to school, why don't you stay home and take care of your mother so your sisters can graduate and your brother can go into the Navy?" So I said, that sounds good to me.
Gene took care of his mother for 3 years. She died in 1954 at the age of 50.
Even though she was deceased and I was looking at her coffin, I did promise her I would go back to school. And I went back to Lane Elementary School and went to South High School.
By this time, Gene was a couple of years older than the other kids and a couple of years bigger and stronger. He was the star of the football team, but not of the classroom.
Then came this Southern teacher, the beginning of my junior year, he was writing on the blackboard. And when he got finished, I raised my hand to get his attention. And he looked back and he said, "Oh, the big football player, he wants some help." Just like a tennis match, all the kids' heads turned at the same time and looked at me. And I was so embarrassed. I just stood up and said, "To hell with this white man's learning. I'll join the Navy."
Gene wanted to see the world and find a new sense of purpose and direction. Instead, he played football. Back then, Navy bases had football teams, and Gene was a star as a running back, defensive back, and field goal kicker.
And I was big stuff on the base. I didn't even have to show my ID when I left the base or came back on it because everybody knew me.
After 3 years with the Navy, Gene moved back to Akron and got a job at the Goodyear plant where his mother and father had once worked. He figured his football days were over. But one day in 1960, Gene was reading the paper.
As good as I could read, and I saw that the American Football League was being formed, and there was a player out of Fort Carson Army Base that had signed with the Broncos.
Gene figured that if an Army player could make the Denver Broncos, so could he. So he decided to write a letter to the general manager, Dean Griffin. He spent a long time on it, looking up words in the dictionary and getting help from his older sister. He sent his letter to the Denver Broncos, and then he waited.
That's Only a Game's Karen Given speaking with Gene Mingo, and we're going to do something a little different with this story. We'll come back to it in a bit, but first, it's time for three stories you should know. Former USA Gymnastics and Michigan State doctor Larry Nassar, who has pleaded guilty to multiple counts of molestation, is expected to be sentenced early next week. Scores of women made victim impact statements in court this past week, and that is where we're going to begin our discussion. I'm joined by sports writer and editor Patrick Ruby via Skype and Sports Illustrated's Joan Neeson. Welcome back to both of you.
Always good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Joan, why don't you go first?
The story of Larry Nassar, the disgraced former USA Gymnastics and Michigan State doctor, has really caught my attention over the course of the fall. And on Thursday, the latest news out of it was that he'd sent a letter to the judge saying that it was mentally very tough for him to listen to all of the victims who were testifying at the sentencing, which is just kind of the latest pretty disgusting twist in this whole scandal, that he would even think to say such a thing after what these women went through. And this is just really interesting to me in that more and more of these high-profile gymnasts are speaking out about their abuse at the hands of Nassar. Allie Raisman, who has won 3 gold medals, she's condemned the way that USA Gymnastics has handled everything. Michaela Maroney, another of her teammates, filed a lawsuit last month claiming that USA Gymnastics forced her to sign a confidentiality agreement in order to keep her allegations against Nassar secret. And then earlier this week, Simone Biles added her name to the ranks of people who were abused by Nassar. And that's what's attracted the public eye. But what's interesting to me are the 80 or so victims who aren't even anything close to famous. I think this case can set an example that even these girls who no one knows who they are, they never went to the Olympics, they can have big voices too. Kyle Stevens, who was one of the women Nassar abused starting when she was 6 years old, she said it best this week during the sentencing. Her quote was, "Little girls don't stay little forever. They grow into strong women that return to destroy your world." And that just really stuck with me as a way that this case can kind of serve as an example that even the no-name athletes can have an impact in stopping some of these crimes from going forward.
Patrick Joan sounds optimistic about what could come out of this. Do you share her optimism in terms of where we might go with this?
I think some good things can come out of this case, but some things have to happen for that to happen. I mean, first of all, both the USA Gymnastics and Michigan State, some earth needs to be salted there. Like, the level to which they were warned, they had people telling them there was something wrong, and the level to which they chose to cover it up, deny it, and preserve the power structure and preserve the institutional brand and reputation over protecting the young women in their care, you know, it's inexcusable. And you have to make a very harsh example of that. You have to create some sort of incentive for the next time, the next place, for that not to happen. Unfortunately, you would think that just being moral is enough, as we've seen over and over in all sorts of cases of institutional abuse and power and cover up. It's never enough.
The other thing is, I hope that discussions like this and the case like the Nassar case coming out will have implications beyond sports, really moving over into the culture at large.
Definitely. You have to look to hopefully find the positive. And of course, I agree with what Patrick said about, you know, these institutions have to pay for this. But we have to be able to find the positive. And hopefully that is that a little girl out there can say, all right, Simone Biles had something terrible happen to her and she spoke up and everyone still loved her and she still went on to be a champion in her sport. I can speak up too.
We're going to move on to my topic. On Thursday, the Concussion Legacy Foundation announced the launch of Flag Football Under 14. This is a campaign designed to encourage parents to keep their children out of tackle football until the kids are at least 14 years old. Chris Nowinski, he's the head of the Concussion Legacy Foundation, was among the people participating in this announcement in New York. I spoke recently with him, and Chris had a great idea. He said the NFL should really get behind this and tell people our sport is so tough that little kids shouldn't play it until they get older. I don't think the NFL is going to do that. Pop Warner, meanwhile, assures us that youth football is getting safer all the time, and there are those who suggest that this initiative is more evidence that we're becoming a nation of namby-pambies, but I'm all for it. I think moving the kids to playing flag football is at least one small step toward preserving the brains of the population at large.
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime these stories like this are in the news and this is being talked about is a good thing for the sport of football and for, like you said, the children who are getting involved. The more we learn about these subconcussive hits and just that every hit counts, I think we need to be talking about this more and more.
I think this is an idea that's way overdue. All the research that's been done does seem to indicate one of the issues with brain trauma in football is simply a matter of exposure. The more you get hit over a longer period of time, the higher the risk of serious, lasting, and consequential damage to your brain. So the more you can reduce exposure, the more you can reduce risk. There are plenty of examples, by the way, of great NFL players who did not start playing football until they were in high school. So I think the argument of, if I don't start at age 6, it's too late, doesn't really apply. Football is not tennis. You're not trying to groove your ground strokes. And the other thing I think that's important to note here, and why you don't see the football industry really getting behind this the way they could and probably should, because if you say no tackle until 14, someone's going to think to themselves, well, what's so different about a 16-year-old's brain? And why is high school football okay? And now you've opened a big can of worms.
And a can of worms that I, for one, would very much like to see opened. This news conference that I spoke about included Harry Carson, who used to play in the NFL and who has acknowledged that he has some CTE-related issues he feels already, and Nick Bonacani, who's a former NFL guy and a Hall of Famer, and they're both on board for this, so we're not alone. Patrick, time for your story.
This was something that gave everybody a good laugh this week. Following a testy game between the Los Angeles Clippers and Houston Rockets, a group of four Houston players, a raiding party, if you will, supposedly went to the supposedly found their way to the LA locker room to have a confrontation. Now, depending on which reports you believe, they were led by Chris Paul. They marched through a secret corridor between the two locker rooms, and this occurred while Houston's Clint Capella knocked on the front door of the locker room to create a diversion. But we found out later that actually Capella may have been Tariq Black, who was just hanging out lifting weights when he heard some commotion. And Chris Paul may have actually been a peacemaker, not an instigator. Anyway, what matters is this whole incident was viewed as a joke by virtually everybody. And there was a quote in the ESPN story that I thought summed it up best. It said, "It was classic NBA. None of these guys were going to fight. And I think that's the real amazing thing here. Because in basically a decade and a half, not fighting has become classic NBA. That wasn't always the case. I'm actually old enough to remember Bad News Marvin Barnes. I can remember Charles Barkley putting Larry Bird in a headlock while Dr. J punched him. And even in 2004, we had the Malice in the Palace, which was actually a tipping point. You know, you saw the league change their rules to drastically discourage fighting. And I think this really changed the risk-reward calculus of fighting. So I think there's a lesson here. For all sports, prohibition can actually work. Culture can actually change. And I think it also helps that unlike helmet-to-helmet hits in football, fighting isn't a necessary or even inevitable part of actually playing basketball. And by the way, that makes me wonder, what is the NHL waiting for?
It seemed a lot like comic opera to me. I love some of the dramatic language, too. You know, the secret passageway. I spoke with someone who used to work in PR for an NBA team who was saying it's just a hallway that they use to get back and forth where the ball boys hang out.
I totally imagine like somebody like taking a certain hanger off a locker and then it just turns like a secret passageway in like Bruce Wayne's house. And then you can like go to the OT's locker room.
See, if that was the way the NBA worked, I'd watch more games.
I think Cloak and Dagger NBA would be a hit for sure.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Sports Illustrated's Joan Neeson and sports writer and editor Patrick Ruby, whose writing you can find in The Atlantic, Washingtonian Magazine, and elsewhere. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
After the break, we'll continue with Gene Mingo's story, including what happened nearly two decades after he retired from football.
And I got sort of afraid. That's what the drug was doing to me. It was making me become paranoid. And I was able to buy a gun.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR. Our thanks go out to Dirt Dog Golfer for calling our show delightful in an Apple Podcasts review. Wonderful meander through sports makes me a little smarter while I laugh and cry at the charming stories. Keep it up. Will do, Dirt Dog Golfer, and please keep it up with those reviews, Only a Game listeners. They really do help others find our show.
It's Maria Hinojosa, host of NPR's Latino USA, the podcast that takes you inside the Latino conversation. Each week, we'll take you into one story that will fascinate and often surprise you. Listen to Latino USA on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. When last we left the story of Gene Mingo, the year was 1960 and the American Football League had just been formed. Gene wrote to the Denver Broncos, hoping they would sign him. Only a Game's Karen Given picks up the story from there.
Gene didn't have to wait long to hear back from the Denver Broncos. The AFL was in direct competition with the NFL for players. AFL teams were desperate to sign anyone with experience. Broncos GM Dean Griffin responded personally.
He sent me a contract for $6,500. That was in 1960. I signed it right quick. I didn't know that I was going to make history a little later on.
To earn that $6,500, Gene would have to make the team. And that was far from settled. He was one of 100 players who reported to training camp. One day, Gene was laughing and running plays with some of his fellow hopefuls while Broncos head coach Frank Vilcek evaluated the team's kicking prospects. It wasn't going well.
And Coach Vilcek stopped the practice. He was down on the lower field. He blew his whistle and he said, excuse my language, but he said, God D, I'm trying to build a effing football team, and you guys are up there effing off. And one of my teammates, I believe it was Bill Miller, said, Mingo can kick. And so Phil Chuck said, well, if you can kick, come on down here. And one of my teammates pushed me out and said, man, you better go down there. You know, the more positions you can play, the easier it is for you to make the team. Well, I went down. I kicked the first ball. It went through beautiful. It had high trajectory, and it took off and went through. And we moved it back 10 yards, and I kicked another one through, and he moved it over to another hash mark. And I kicked it, and it went off to the right like a golfer slice. And he said, "Oh, get out of here." I started to turn and walk away, and something, I heard something in my ear say, "Don't give up. Go back. Go ask him for another chance." And that's exactly what I did.
This time, and every time thereafter, his kicks split the uprights. Gene says back then, kicker, like quarterback, was a job reserved for white players. But Frank Filchuk wasn't worried about that. He wanted to win games. So the team's trainer, Fred Posey, fitted Gene with a kicking shoe.
He said, "Mingo, let me tell you something." He said, "You were one lucky son of a you-know-what, because they were going to cut you that Saturday."
Gene became the first black kicker in the AFL and later the NFL. The next black kicker wouldn't join the league until 1985.
The season opened on a warm, pleasant night just a stone's throw from the hallowed halls of Harvard University as the Broncos and the Boston Patriots played the first game in regular season competition ever performed in the American Football League.
I was sort of jittery and everything. I had to go out and do a job. And I don't remember the score at halftime.
7-3. The Broncos were ahead.
But anyway, our punt return and kickoff man got hurt. And Filchuk was walking around the Quonset hut. He said, "Mingo, you're running back kickoffs and punt returns." I was scared. I was nervous. Somebody gave me what they called back then a Benny. It's supposed to brighten you up. Well, I didn't know how bright it was going to be when we stepped at that Quonset hut and the lights of the stadium was so bright, I thought it was daylight.
Then in the third quarter, Gene Mingo electrified the crowd of better than 20,000 with a magnificent 76-yard punt return down the sidelines, and a late Boston touchdown resulted in a final score of Denver 13 and Boston 10.
That highlights guy is skipping over something pretty important, because after that 76-yard punt return, Gene was supposed to kick the extra point, right?
You're absolutely right. It was my job to kick the extra point. Well, I didn't realize how drained I was. I kicked a big divot in the ground. I was mad at myself, but at least running that touchdown back won the game for us.
That day put Gene's career on a rather unusual path, because after that, whenever one of his teammates got injured, Gene raised his hand and volunteered to go in.
We didn't have that many players. I ran halfback, I ran fullback, wide receiver, I played defensive back, I ran back punt returns, kickoffs.
Decades later, Lamar Hunt, one of the founders of the AFL, spotted Gene and his wife at a Broncos game. He called his own wife and sons over and said, "I want you all to meet Gene Mingo. This man helped save the American Football League."
They were coming to see Gene Mingo play. I was an oddity. I went out there like Al Jolson. I put on a show for those people.
At the end of that first AFL season, Gene Mingo was the league's leading scorer with 123 points. He was also the best kicker in the league with the highest field goal percentage.
When I heard they were going to have an all-star team, I expected my name to be on there.
But it wasn't.
I was a little hurt, thrown back, or however you want to say it. I kept wondering, you know, you led the league in scoring. What's wrong? It just broke my heart, that's all.
Did it feel like it was because of the color of your skin?
It had to be.
That off-season, Gene found himself at his old high school, working out alongside future Hall of Famer Willie Davis. Davis had been following Gene's career in the AFL.
He said, "Let me tell you one thing, Mingo." He said, "You may be kicking the ball now, but they don't really want you. You have to keep your nose clean and do what they say, because they don't want a black man playing pro football today." And that stuck with me. I tried to stay as clean as I could and follow the rules.
When Gene came back to camp in 1961, the Broncos had brought in 7 field goal kickers, looking for someone to replace him. How did Gene respond? By teaching them how to kick.
One of my teammates, Chuck Gavin, who has passed away, asked me, he said, "Mingo, what are you doing? Don't you know they want to take your job?" I said, "Chuck, they can't outkick me, so why not teach them? Until they outkick me, they ain't going to take my job." That's how much I believed in myself. I led the league in scoring again in 62 with 137 points. Wasn't selected to the All-Star team. And some of my teammates said, "Man, it's a shame they want to treat you that way."
But Gene would have done better to remember the advice Willie Davis gave him after that first season. Because after one incident in 1964, many felt that he had not kept his nose clean. Gene says it was the beginning of his unraveling.
It was something that happened that I had no intentions of having happen, but it did. And I have to own up to that. I had just been married to my second wife for, I believe, 6 months.
The Broncos were playing in Oakland. That's where Gene's wife's best girlfriend, Edna, lived. She invited Gene and one of his teammates, Willie West, over for dinner.
Louisiana gumbo, collard greens, cornbread, fried chicken, all Southern foods and stuff.
Edna invited 2 of her female co-workers to join them. After dinner, Gene and Willie's ride back to the hotel didn't show. Curfew was fast approaching, so Edna's co-workers offered to drive them instead.
Time was slipping by, and I said, "Edna, let them take us back." And so it was a little VW bug. Willie West and myself, we got in the back seat, cramped up.
The 2 women climbed into the front.
Driving like a bat out of heck, and got us back to the hotel. It was gravel in the parking lot. I guess it made enough noise that 2 of my teammates heard us pull in and looked out the window. And one girl got out the driver's seat and they saw that she was a white girl.
After saying goodbye to the women and going into the hotel, Gene stopped in the hallway to chat with another teammate who was rushing in after a night out. And when Gene got to his room, he says he was surprised to find the women there. He knew assistant coach Red Miller would arrive any second for bed check.
I sort of panicked, and I said, "Get in a closet and get in the shower." That's what they did. Well, Red Miller came to the door, and we act like everything was cool. And I looked at Willie. I sort of whispered, "Did you invite him up?" And he said, "No, I thought you did."
The women stayed. Gene says nothing really happened, though he wanted it to. And then, about an hour later...
Here comes Red Miller back up and knocked on the door and said, "I hear you have 2 white girls in your room."
Gene and Willie were told to report to Broncos GM Dean Griffin the next morning.
I begged the man. I said, "You know, you were at my wedding." I said, "There was no way I expected to come out here and to invite any girl to my room." I said, "I'll beat the Oakland Raiders myself if you just give me a chance." He said, "No, what y'all did was detrimental to the team." They put us on the plane before the game even started. And when we got back to the Denver airport, the media were there. And my wife was there. Irma was there. That was just it. That was in the 60s, and you know how prejudiced everybody was.
Gene says his white teammates had gotten caught with women in their rooms after bed check, and no one ever got in trouble. But the Broncos released Gene, and his career never fully recovered. Neither did his marriage. Irma stayed with him as he played in Oakland and Miami. She had moved back home to Denver by the time Gene was in Washington. That's where the last important moment of Gene Mingo's football career happened. It was in a game against Philadelphia.
I kicked off, and Timmy Brown was with the Philadelphia Eagles. He caught the kickoff and broke through our line of defense, and I was the last guy there. And I hit Timmy Brown from the front, and at the same time I hit Timmy Brown from the front, Chris Hamburg was hitting him from the back. I felt like somebody had hit me in the middle of my head with an axe.
Gene went down, and then he jumped right back up. Later, people told him that he had played a brilliant game, even shouting orders to the offense and defense from the sidelines.
After the game was over, Brig Owens was around the corner from me. He said, "Hey, Mingo, what you gonna do tonight after you shower, man?" I said, "Well, after I shower, I'm going outside and get my wife and son and take them to dinner." He said, "You gonna do what?" I said, "You heard me. I'm going to go get my wife and son and take them to dinner." He said, "Doc, you better come take a look at Mingo. His wife and son are in Denver." This was told to me because I didn't know any of it. I wake up in the hospital a Wednesday afternoon.
Gene was still convinced that he was going to be late for the game until a doctor handed him a Monday morning newspaper.
And the headlines in the sporting section read, "Mingo kicks tying field goal 35-35. I didn't even know I had played.
That was 3 days after the game. Gene stayed in the hospital again that night. He was released on Thursday and immediately went to the stadium for practice. But Washington's coach, Otto Graham, sent him home for one more night of rest. Gene returned to the stadium on Friday.
I put on my practice clothes, went out, kicked off, kicked field goals, extra points and everything, feeling pretty good. Went back in, started packing my bags, and the trainer came in. He said, "Gene," he says, "I don't want to see you in the hallway." Well, he was laying up against the brick wall there. He had his right leg brace name on the wall, and he had a pad of paper or notebook in his hand, and he didn't look me in my face. He said, "I'm going to have to let you go. You kicked too erratic in the game Sunday." I said, "I did what?"
At just that moment, the team doctor came down the hallway, and he overheard the conversation.
And the doctor said, "Otto, the man played the game under instinct. He didn't even know he was there. And even today, all I remember is hitting Timmy Brown and feeling that axe hitting my head. That's what it felt like." I was so mad, they released me.
That was in 68. In 69, Gene played for the Steelers. They released him too.
And I said, "The hell with it. I'll just stop playing. You guys don't want me anyway." Karen, do you know I'm the only halfback in NFL history to throw two touchdown passes over 50 yards in a game? That I've scored points six different ways? There are not any other players in the NFL that have scored six different ways.
Actually, there were. They're both in the Hall of Fame. Gene settled in Denver and tried to go back to get his GED, but
everybody in the classroom were younger than me, but they knew the name Gene Mingo. They looked up to me. But that looking up to me made me feel just like I was in high school. I was embarrassed. And so I dropped out.
Gene went back again and dropped out again. He says he felt like he was just a person who couldn't learn. So he worked jobs that didn't require a high school diploma. He met a woman named Sally. She'd eventually become his third wife and got a job driving a cement truck.
My back started to hurt me, and then that's when things got out of hand, Karen. I got involved with using cocaine to help take the pain away from my back, and I learned how to cook it up and smoke it. And in 1986, I was inducted into the Summit County Sports Hall of Fame. Do you know who's in that?
No, I don't.
I have to say, this is not where I thought this story was going. Because in 1986, it was September 10th, 1986 to be exact, something happened that would have a much greater impact on Gene's life.
Well, okay, so I want to talk more about the Hall of Fame in a bit, but first we have to sort of talk about what happened.
Okay. I told you that I got involved with cocaine. I did it for about a year and a half, almost 2 years. I bought some cocaine off of this one dealer, and evidently it wasn't the same stuff.
When the dealer arrived with the cocaine, he asked Gene to cook it up and share it with him. Gene said yes. When the drugs were gone, the man asked Gene to cook up some more. But Gene didn't know where his stash was. He'd asked Sally to hide it from him.
He stormed out of the house, and I got sort of afraid. That's what the drug was doing to me. It was making me become paranoid. I got in my car and I went down. I wanted to buy a gun to protect myself and my wife. I went to Dave Cook.
That was a sporting goods store in Denver.
And I was able to buy a gun. And I loaded it up and I put it in my boot to get in the house. My wife didn't know this. She had fixed dinner, so we sat down and ate dinner.
Afterwards, Sally and Gene went into the family room, but Gene was jumpy, watching the door more than the television.
She knew something was wrong. Well, to make a long story short, I cooked up a little bit more and was doing it. My dog jumped off the bed. I saw his shadow.
Gene grabbed Sally. He says he was trying to protect her.
She didn't know I had the gun. And as I was pulling down, protecting her and me, the gun went off. The bullet went into her arm and into her side.
Sally was rushed to the hospital and into surgery. Gene was taken to the police station and booked. He didn't know if Sally was dead or alive.
That's Only a Game's Karen Given speaking with Gene Mingo. Keep listening. We'll be back with the conclusion of Gene's story after my conversation with Charlie Pierce. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hello, just dropping in to remind you about Here and Now. We cover the day's most essential news with context so you know the why and what's next. A fast-paced snapshot of the world every day. Listen to Here and Now on NPR One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the conclusion of Gene Mingo's extraordinary story. But now it's time for my conversation with Charlie Pierce about the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Representatives of the two Koreas forged an agreement this week to have athletes from North and South march together when the Winter Olympics begin next month, and the two nations are going to field a joint women's ice hockey team. Maybe we can't draw too many positive conclusions from all this, but limited cooperation is better than no cooperation, right?
Well, it's further proof of the fact that hockey will save the world. Hockey is going to bring all warring parties in the world together, and everyone will play hockey.
Hockey and cheerleaders, because the North Koreans are sending cheerleaders as well.
Yeah, and you got to believe the cheerleaders are awesome, by the way. I mean, this can only be good, right?
Right.
Assuming that the women's ice hockey team doesn't dissolve in, you know, bitter dissension and recrimination. But, yeah, I mean, this can only be the good, and I'm sure they'll get an amazing hand when they walk into the stadium.
The Vikings prepared for this weekend's NFC Championship game by watching film of players slipping and falling. Shouldn't they have been going over plays or something?
Well, no, the field in Philadelphia is a mess and was a mess during the game against the Falcons. The Falcons were on the 1 yard line and were ready to go in for a touchdown that probably would have won the game. And their running back just fell down twice. There was no confidence in the footing there. So the Vikings are not taking any chances.
Until Wednesday night, Charlie, there were six college basketball coaches, men's and women's coaches, who had presided over 1,000 wins. And now there are seven, and I have celebrated the achievements of Barbara Stevens, coach of the women's team at Bentley University before, and I'm biased. She's a friend. Your turn.
She finally got them. I'm so very happy for her. Next stop, Springfield, I hope. Outside of Gino Auriemma and Pat Summitt, I can't think of a better women's basketball coach.
Ted Williams allegedly said that he would have preferred to play baseball in an empty stadium. Two minor league hockey teams had an opportunity to do that on Wednesday night because the home team, Charlotte Checkers, didn't want their fans to drive through a snowstorm. Would this ever happen in Boston, Chicago, or Montreal? This is an argument for going back to the original six, yeah?
Well, I don't know. But the great thing was they also went with a skeleton crew for the game.
Mm.
And the finance guy was the PA announcer. And one of the ticket guys was the guy cleaning the ice. And if I might add, the chief operating officer of the team was running the music in the empty arena. Why they needed music in the empty arena is anybody's guess.
As of Wednesday, 28,000 Pittsburgh Pirate fans had signed a petition asking Major League Baseball to force Pirates owner Bob Nutting to sell the team. What's their complaint?
Well, their complaint is Bob Nutting is in this for the dough, and he's doing the Florida Marlins chop shop operation in Pittsburgh. He traded Andrew McCutchen for a bag of magic beans. I mean, he's only in it to enrich himself, and this is one of the greatest fan bases in all of baseball. There's no question about that. This is the city of Honus Wagner, of Roberto Clemente, of Willie Stargell, and, by the way, of the nicest new ballpark there is. Bill, you and I have said this before. The one unsolvable problem for a fan base is a bad owner. They can't do anything about it. I mean, the owner doesn't have to care.
The Philadelphia Flyers retired Eric Lindros' jersey on Thursday night. I am going to assume you think that's a long overdue development.
I'm really happy for him because I got to know the Lindros family pretty well back in the day. And, of course, Eric had to retire because he was one of the very first concussion casualties in professional sports. I'm very happy for him. I'm very happy for his parents. He came into the league in a very strange way. There was a lot of prejudice and ill feeling by the NHL old guard against him. He had a terrific career. He should have had a much better career. And I think this is an honor he deserves.
And finally, Charlie, if you are a skier in New Gloucester, Maine, you have been officially warned about aggressive dive-bombing owls. Boy, Hitchcock's The Birds was scary enough, and they were mostly pretty small compared to dive-bombing aggressive owls.
Yeah, I mean, they, according to owl experts, they're breeding during the winter. These are barred owls. They're breeding during the winter, and they get very territorial. And if you come by on your skis, out come the birds.
It's a new sport. High-risk Olympic skiing.
The sign is wonderful. There's a sign posted, caution, an aggressive owl lives here.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
Today, Only a Game's Karen Given has been telling the story of Gene Mingo, the first black kicker in the NFL. When we last left Gene, the year was 1986. It was nearly two decades after he'd retired from pro football and turned to cocaine to treat the pain in his back and neck. One night, after a day of heavy drug use, Gene accidentally shot his wife, Sally. Sally was taken to the hospital, Gene was taken to jail, and he didn't know whether Sally was dead or alive.
I was crying so hard that I fell asleep. And when I woke up, it was a half hour later. The reason I woke up, I was hearing voices in that jail cell. And I knew where I was. And I said, how could... And I heard the voices, everything's going to be okay. We're here. Take it easy. It'll be all right. And I began to open my eyes. And my mother was standing to the right. My dad was standing next to her.
Gene says the figures in his jail cell were all looking off to the side at the same thing.
And I started to turn my head, and I began to see this white creamy robe with this braided sash. And I started to look a little further to the top of the shoulder, and I began to see this dark brown satin silky looking hair. Karen, I believe I looked in the face of God, and all he did was smiled at me.
Gene never took cocaine again. The most serious charges against him were dropped after Sally's decision not to cooperate with the prosecution. Months later, Sally spoke on Gene's behalf in open court, and Gene was sentenced to 2 years probation. The bullet had lodged near Sally's spine. Doctors told her she'd never get full mobility back in her arm and shoulder. But slowly, over time, and with the help of a therapist, Gene and Sally rebuilt their relationship. Every time I spoke with Gene on the phone, Sally was in the background, making sure he didn't forget to tell me anything important. As part of his probation, Gene was required to find a job. The probation office suggested he try at an addiction treatment facility in Denver. He met with a doctor in charge, hoping that maybe they'd hire him to work in public relations. Instead, the doctor asked if he'd be interested in becoming a counselor.
I said, Doc, you have to have your college diploma for that, don't you? He said, no, all you have to have is a GED. And I looked at him and I said, Doc, I don't even have that.
So Gene went back to school, to the same place where he had failed to earn his GED twice before. This time, he says, he had a purpose, a reason to push through the embarrassment. He earned his GED and moved on to get his certification as a drug and alcohol counselor.
Do you know I didn't get less than a 95 on the majority of my tests? And there was a time in my life that I didn't think I could learn.
Gene went on to work as a counselor for a decade. Then he helped families hold interventions. He says he's now recognized as often by those who want to thank him for that work as he is by those who remember what he did on the football field. But Gene didn't start taking cocaine because he wanted to get high. He started taking it because he wanted to get rid of the pain. And when he got clean, the pain came back.
Do you know I've had 5 back operations and I've had 3 neck surgeries because Otto Graham and the Washington Redskins didn't tell me how bad it was. They didn't let me know anything. All they did was let me come home. That's all they did was cut me loose and let me come home.
It wasn't until decades later, after he'd retired from the league, that a doctor stood Gene and Sally in front of an X-ray and showed them where the pain came from.
And he looked at me. This doctor had tears in his eyes. He said, you're one lucky fella. You see this spot here? All somebody had to do was come up and tap you on the back to say hello to you, and you could have been paralyzed the rest of your life. That's how bad it was. But the Redskins didn't tell me. I'm a little upset. I get upset with the Redskins, and I hear the NFL talking about concussions. I don't know how many concussions I had playing football, but it was for these owners to make these billions of dollars that they're making, and they're waiting for some of us old players to drop dead so they don't have to pay us. And I have nothing to say.
When Gene and I spoke on the phone before our interview, I warned him that I'd be asking about his whole life, not just his time on the football field. He said, ask me whatever you need to ask. I don't mind. And with everything we talked about, only 2 subjects made him angry: how Washington treated him after his injury and the issue that brought me to him in the first place, the question of whether he belongs in the Hall of Fame.
The reason I'm hurt, everywhere I go, I hear somebody tell me, boy, you were a hell of a player. You should be in the Canton Hall of Fame. Wouldn't you get tired of hearing that when you know what you've done? You would get tired of hearing people tell you, you should be in the Hall of Fame.
After all of his successes and failures, the barriers he broke down, and the mistakes he made, is it any wonder that what Gene Mingo most wants now is to be remembered?
I'll be 80 years old September 22nd, if I make it that far. There's people out there that know what I've done, but unless people from my era speak up or whatever, Gene Mingo may not never be recognized.
That's Gene Mingo speaking to Only a Game's Karen Given. Believe it or not, there's more to Gene's story, and you can read about it in his autobiography, What Have You Done Now, Eugene? Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from Gene Mingo. My gosh, he's got nothing more to say. I guess next week we'll have to come up with some other stories. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.